Robert Frost, distinguished poet and philosopher, faces the Fourth Estate in just a moment as Monitor joins Meet the Press. Ready for the spontaneous, unrehearsed conference are four of America's top news reporters. Their questions do not necessarily reflect their point of view, but may be their way of getting a story for you. Now, here is the moderator of Meet the Press, Ned Brooks.
Welcome once again to Meet the Press. Our guest is the distinguished American poet, Mr. Robert Frost. Since his last visit to Meet the Press, Mr. Frost has received many high honors. Recently, he was chosen as a consultant by the Library of Congress. In the opinion of critics, Mr. Frost has written more poetry that will endure than any other writer of our generation. He has been awarded the Pulitzer Prize in Poetry four times. This spring, the Henry Holt Company, which has been Mr. Frost's publisher for more than 40 years, will bring out a new book of his poems, the first in about 10 years. Mr. Frost is now almost 85 years old, but he still is young in hopes and in dreams, free from despair and pessimism. He is a man of deep loyalties to his land and his people. While he is known as a New England poet, he is the poet of all America. Indeed, it can be said that he is the poet of all mankind. And now seated around the press table, ready to interview Mr. Frost, are Ernest Lindley of Newsweek magazine, May Craig of the Portland, Maine Press Herald, James Reston of the New York Times, and Lawrence E. Spivak, our regular member of the Meet the Press panel. Now, Mr. Frost, if you're ready, we'll start the questions with Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Frost, you once said that poetry isn't too different from politics. Were you just pulling somebody's leg, or were you serious?
Yes, pulling somebody's leg. But I meant it in this way, that the worst politics I ever see is in the poetic world, among the poets, you know. And among the faculties, too, the literary faculty. It's all politics. Life is that. What's the use talking?
You also said, and this is still sticking to politics, that you would like to have a crack at being a statesman on a temporary basis.
Yes.
That must mean that you have some things you'd like Congress to do. Can you tell us what?
I'd like them to do a little more for the arts, I suppose. I'm not too particular about that. And I'd like them to make a better... I suppose I'd tell you what I'd like. I'd like to be there to talk a figure of speech. I'd like to tell them that I was interested in the House, Congress, and in the Senate as a handicapper, and in the Supreme Court as a referee. See? And I'd like to get going on that subject, the difference between a referee and a handicapper. And I'd like to put them both in their place. And I'd like to admit that I've been rather opposed to handicapping. I never liked the Sunday school picnic sporting event because there was too much handicapping in it. I like everybody, if I really have my way, I like everybody to start from scratch. You know, a real competition. I like Casey Stengel to be just as strong as he can be without anybody stopping him by law or anything else.
Mr. Reston.
Mr. Frost, why do you take so many of your images and metaphors from the world of games and sports?
It's a strange thing that I do. I played games, I suppose, and I don't think anybody can think right in this world who didn't play games sometime in his life. First thing I caught myself saying was that of this kind, I'd as soon write free verse as play tennis with the net down. That brought tennis in. Then I came to this. I'd been working my way toward this Sunday school picnic idea. What my difficulty with the government, the New Deal, and all that is the difficulty with spoiling a good competition, taking too much. I suppose I'm wrong about it. Might be, but I'm wrong from the old habit of loving to see a thing start with scratch.
Mr. Frost, sir, are you a happier man in your 80s than you were in your 50s?
Than in when?
Than in your 50s or your 40s?
No. No, it's a funny thing. I've always been happy, unhappy combination. It blends, you know. It makes, like they say, drink, you know, makes you happy, make you sad.
What has happened to the American character, Mr. Frost, in these last 30 years? Are we a merrier people at Christmas time?
That's interesting to say. I think, that'd be a hard thing for me to judge. We're always rather merry people. Mr. Spivak was telling me that he tried to run a magazine called American Humor, and it wasn't funny enough, he said. That was some years ago, was it, Mr. Spivak?
Mrs. Craig.
Mr. Frost, did you hear what the president said in his message from the Atlas missile from outer space?
From heaven? You mean?
He said he was giving a message of peace on earth, goodwill to man. And of course, the Atlas is now going round the world. That was a prose poem, don't you think?
Yes, I didn't hear it.
It was a prose poem. He said, peace on earth, goodwill to man.
Do you think the word peace makes it a prose poem?
Yes. Do you have much hope for the world that has its mind on military things?
Yes.
How do you think we can save ourselves from destroying each other?
We were sent here to destroy each other in honest competition.
Mr. Lindley.
Mr. Frost, next summer in Moscow, as part of the Soviet-American Cultural Exchange, there's to be an American exposition. And the suggestion has been made that you should be one of the exhibits. That is, that you should go to Moscow and lecture. Would you be willing to do that?
I suppose so. If they'll make me Exhibit A.
In one of your poems, Bill Soil, a political pastoral, you say, were I dictator, I'd let things take their course, and then I'd claim the credit for the outcome.
Yes.
Would you enjoy giving that piece of advice directly to Khrushchev?
Yes. Yes, I should. I'm always thinking that if I got into a position of power, I'd mainly let things take their course and touch them a little here and then, take credit for the whole thing, sure.
Do you think of any other pieces of advice you'd like to give the Soviet government and people if you were to go there?
No, that's one. I hadn't thought of that, but I'd like to tell them that I think there's a certain validity in, a great validity in our great difference with each other. That there's always the utopian dream that they have, and there's always the civilized dream that we have. And that I'm willing to see them as standoff, and that magnanimity is that which enjoys a standoff.
In one of your recent interviews, you said that you would rather perish as Athens than survive as Sparta.
Yes.
Is that the real choice, as you see it?
Yes, a good deal. The Spartan eyes, I meant by the... Yes, that's the choice. Let's us not Spartanize. I was thinking about what they're trying to do to our schools, to harden them up and speed them up, to contend with the Russians. And I just thought I'd rather perish as an Athenian than live as that kind of a Spartan. What I want the schools to do is let them harden up a little, let them speed up a little, but I want them to tone up, and that means to Athenianize them.
Mr. Frost, we mentioned at the start of the program that you have a new book coming out, a new book of your poems. I wonder, perhaps you could say one of them for us. You perhaps have a favorite. Yes. Hearing you say your poems has always been a high spot on our programs with you.
Yes.
Is there one that you have as a favorite?
Well, no, some of them are too long. Suppose I say one, like, very political in its implications. It's called The Objection to Being Stepped On, which rules the world, I think. At the end of the row, I stepped on the toe of an unemployed hoe. It rose in offense and struck me a blow in the seat of my sense. It wasn't to blame, but I called it a name, and I must say it dealt me a blow that I felt like malice prepense. You may call me a fool, but was there a rule the weapon should be turned into a tool? But what do we see? The first tool I step on turned into a weapon.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Frost, while you're reciting poetry, I wonder whether you'd say the one about the hardship of accounting, which I think may seem particularly appropriate to this season of the year when people are spending so much money they don't know where it came from or where it's gone.
That's a little squib of mine. It's all in one rhyme, five lines. The hardship of accounting. Never ask of money spent where the spender thinks it went. Nobody was ever meant to remember or invent what he did with every cent.
Don't you think that might be a good one to stamp on the heart of every Internal Revenue agent?
Bankers, it's been published in some banker's magazine, you know. It's for the really written for the benefit of income tax reporters.
Mr. Frost, I'd like to come back to the voice from the sky. Do you think it's going to do any good for the president to speak of peace from the sky over and over again?
Somebody said to me the other day that the Wright brothers, one of them a great friend of mine, the Wright brothers never thought of all the harm they were going to do with their airplanes, did they? And I said, oh no. The first thing the Wright brothers did when they had a plane that would fly and land safely, they went to the Army with it, thinking of all the harm they could possibly do. Not peace. If you want to talk peace one way, like this way, just say bombs for peace. Sure, I'm in favor of bombs for peace and sewing machines for peace. Anything for peace, if it's the peace I want.
Mr. Frost, change the subject just a bit and go back to your poetry. When you wrote, "The Earth's the Right Place for Love,"
yeah.
I don't know where it is likely to be better. Did you mean that this is the best of all possible worlds and that there is no future in death?
Nothing, no future that we know anything about. And I meant a lot of things about love, all kinds of love.
You're going to keep it a secret from us?
Not just loving kindness.
You're going to keep what you mean about love a secret from us?
Keep it from you?
Yeah.
Yes.
What you meant about love?
Yeah, I could tell you a lot of things about Anchises and Venus and all that sort of thing, but I won't go into that.
We're all ears.
Yeah, I bet you are.
Mr. Reston.
Mr. Frost, should we have a poet laureate in this country?
It seems as if some sort of recognition would help a little more recognition than just consultant. I was down there complaining of this word, consultant. I thought I was brought down to be consulted on all subjects. See, turned out I was only here to be consulted about poetry. And so I rebelled and I said I'd only been consulted. I hadn't been consulted at all, really. I'd only been consulted three times from the White House, once from the Supreme Court, and not at all by Congress. And they said, well, you won't expect to be. You only be consulted by poets. And all I get is a fellow that wanders in there with some poems that he's going to carry to the sub-Arctic with him. He's been appointed poet laureate to deep freeze.
Sir, they say there's a lot of talk in the country at the present time about the anti-intellectualism of the American people, that poets are not appreciated and so on. What has been your experience about that?
I take little stock in that. It's true that there's always in the world a scorn of the intellectual, the religious scorn of the intellectual, as well as a poetic, as a business scorn of the intellectual, the egghead word. And that's just too bad. I don't pay much attention to it. It's always been there.
Is it getting better or worse?
No, it comes in waves. We may be getting a wave of it right now. So as to defeat Adlai Stevenson.
Mr. Frost, you indicate some dissatisfaction with your arrangements with the Library of Congress. Does that mean that you do not intend to remain there?
Oh, no. I'll stay to see things through. I'm just going to treat myself as if I was there to be consulted by everybody.
Wait till they come along.
Yes. Call for them, summon them. Come to consult.
We'll have to give you the subpoena power.
Just my natural wit.
Mrs. Craig.
Mr. Frost, do you regard the Russian Zhivago as more of a poet than a prose writer? Pasternak, who wrote Dr. Zhivago.
I can't speak about his writing. I haven't read it, and it's all in translation. I have no way of judging his poetry. They say it's translated, and somebody is going to send me a book of his in translation. And I understand. I never read a book of poetry translated, but that I think it's lost its poetry, that's all. That's my definition of poetry that's gone wrong. A poem, a poetry, is that which is lost from both prose and verse when translated.
Don't you think it was quite logical that the Soviet Union should crack down on him because his poetry was a danger to the communist system?
Oh, yeah, that's their lookout, and that's a very...
Don't you think poets deal more with life and death than others do, and that we need that in this country, too?
Yes, I guess we got it.
What
you probably know, I've talked about this so many times, that Homer, the greatest poet of all, was a beggar all his life. He wasn't treated any better than I am, anyway.
Yes. What do you, as a poet, think is the meaning and purpose of life?
Of life?
Yes, sir.
I imagine the meaning of it is to dive further into the material, for you know not what reason. The ethereal, the spiritual, diving into the material. Always at the fear that, you know, always in the fear of losing the meaning some way, but deeper and deeper into the material. I call it materiality is our destiny, materiality. And our danger is materialism. And materialism is when the meaning gets lost in the material. Just as in an article you write or a poem you write, when you know you lost the meaning, get out of hand a little, or in your life, or when you're writing the doctor's thesis, you're always... That should be your misgiving all the time. Am I losing my meaning? Is there something carried out of meaning? Or have the material been too much for me? Then we perish of materialism. That's what my long poem is about in my new book. It's called, the book is to be called The Great Misgiving That Becomes a Soul. It's like the fear of God, that you lose God, that you lose meaning, that the material will be too much for you. But it's got to be material. You've got to, and one of my words in the poem is, you've got to substantiate your claim to be in anybody or alive or anything. Substantiate.
Mr. Lindley.
Mr. Frost, Do you think American civilization has improved or deteriorated during your lifetime?
I think it's made its way in forward, natural way, you know. We're so rich that we're like like rich parents that wish they knew how to give their children the hardships that made them so rich.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the young people today. Do you think they're more promising? Do they have a better opportunity? Are they harder, more alert than those of a generation or two ago?
I've lived with them all these years, you know. Live with them now very thick. I'm very thick with them. I suppose I think well of them.
Well, do you think they're better than their fathers or grandfathers?
The fear is they won't be if they made too comfortable and to have their life too easy. That's what I just said, you know, that we're like a rich father that wishes he knew how to give his son the hardships that made the father such a man. We're in that sort of position. Give him commando training, you know, do something to him. And we can't. There seems to be no answer to that. Some very rich families have come down now three generations to show plenty of character.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Frost, you've often spoken of courage as one of the great human virtues. Why do you place so much emphasis on courage?
Because courage is the whole thing in art or in politics or in business. Enterprise is one great thing, isn't it? Enterprise is one. Great nation, great business, great art, great, and all with great courage. I like to tell about a lady I met not long ago who said, isn't it the saddest thing in the world that courage should have to be the greatest thing in the world?
What has been the most important thing, do you think, in your life to you? Love, justice, learning, truth, faith, work, or has it been courage?
That's hard to ask me.
Easy to ask, maybe hard to answer.
I suppose that the greatest thing of all that I would be magnanimity. To achieve magnanimity with all those things, you know, and I don't want to sound like as if I believed in the perfectibility of man or of myself either.
Mr. Reston.
Mr. Frost, you have celebrated New England through most of your life. What is the New England character? Is it different in any special way? More simple, perhaps?
No, it has something left of Cromwell and Milton in it. And it has, I like to say that the Reformation, it's something left of the Reformation in it, and has something of that severity, if you want. It gave so much to the world. It gave the Reformation, and it gave the Counter-Reformation to the world. It gave New England its character. And it spread character all over the United States by spreading school moms all over them, out Kansas and everywhere.
Mrs. Craig.
Mr. Frost, Russians call us barbarians and uncultured. Do you think it would be helpful if we had more Russians visit us?
No. Don't take much. Don't matter. Doesn't matter. Let them come, yeah. I don't count on that sort of thing, going and coming with each other. No, it would be nice if we could learn, if they took some stand of their own, that is definable, you know, I should enjoy it. I don't want to see them fail in their own ideals. I'm afraid that would be my fear, that they have fallen away from their own ideals.
Mr. Lindley.
Mr. Frost, 3 years ago on this program, you were asked if you agreed with T.L. Eliot's line, "This is the way the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper." You disagreed completely. You said it wasn't going to end at all.
No.
Since then, we've had some rather formidable developments in missiles and whatnot. Do you still feel confident that the world, or at least civilization as we know it, isn't going to end?
I got acquainted with a young man in the train who said when I asked him what his occupation was, he said, "It embarrasses me to tell you I'm an exterminator." And I said, "That just comes in handy. I like to go around telling people that when we talk about being wiped out, you know, by the bomb or by a big enough bomb, I like to say I think we're inexterminable, like lice and bedbugs. You can't really exterminate them. There'll always be some in cracks and crevices, and that's us."
Mr. Frost, on that note of philosophy, I think I'm going to have to interrupt. I'm sorry to have to bring our proceedings to a close, but I see that our time is up. Thank you very much, Mr. Robert Frost, for being with us.
Our thanks to Robert Frost and the members of the panel for a stimulating and enlightening half hour. Meet the Press is produced by Lawrence E. Spivak. And now a personal word, if I may. Nobody wants to throw his money away, and I know that you don't. And if you're going to give it away, you want to know where it's going and how it's going to be used. Now, if a man came up to you on the street and asked for a dime, you'd probably hesitate before giving it to him, and maybe deny him entirely. On the other hand, if you saw a neighbor in need of help, you wouldn't hesitate at all. You know what the money will be spent for. And this is true when you give it to the Red Cross. You know your money will buy food, medicine, and shelter for the victims of disaster. It will pay for rebuilding and refurnishing their homes. It will pay for instruction in first aid, swimming, and life-saving. It will finance loans and grants to servicemen and to their families in time of need. And in many areas, it will pay for the collection and distribution of blood for use in hospitals. These are some of the things you help finance when you contribute to the Red Cross. So let's give generously and keep Red Cross on the job. Thank you. 5 minutes of news coming up, and then Monitor continues. But for me, and for this week, time has run out. This is Monty Hall saying thank you and good night.